Welcome to The Big Table with me, Philip Limbury, where we discuss some of the big topics of the day, be it farm animals, food and the environment. And my guest today has been described as a veteran of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, Kostas Stamoulis, who is the Assistant Director General for the Department of Economic and Social Development at the Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO. Kostas, welcome.
Thank you very much.
It was wonderful to hear your keynote speech this morning. We are, of course, at the Financial Times conference looking at global food systems and sustainability and innovation. And you were the opening keynote today. And can I ask, really, Kostas, where you see food fitting in trying to address some of the big issues facing society over the coming decades?
We more and more realize that the food system is an enormous system. It's extremely important in just about every other country. Anything that's associated with what people eat, in a sense, unites people. So it's big from the notional point of view. It's big for the way it looms in the minds of people, and it's also big in the way that will help us achieve or fail in a more sustainable world. So that's why it's all of us eat, and that unites us. And so whenever we talk about food issues, more and more they resonate in a big way in political debates, development debates, etc., sustainability debates.
And I guess one of the big debates of our time is climate change. And we've recently had the warning from the International Panel on Climate Change that we've got 12 years to avert catastrophe. And what do you see as the role of the food system in averting catastrophic climate change? What needs to be done?
Yes. There is a two-way relationship between the food system and climate change. Food system is subjected to the short-term effects of climate change and will be subjected more in the future, but it's also to its long-term effects, that is the rising in the temperature. The short-term effects is violent ups and downs in weather, typhoons, storms, heats and drought. Those have multiplied for an average of 100 a year in 1990 to about 200 a year today. So, and then they're becoming more violent and unpredictable. So it is subjected to effects of climate change in a negative way. As a matter of fact, this tropical countries will be affected negatively from the point of view of production agriculture, while countries in the northern hemisphere and the higher latitudes, they will be affected positively. They will be able to produce more. However, in the long term, there are no pluses and minuses. It will be all minus. It also contributes to climate change. The agriculture and the whole food system in general contribute about 25% to the global greenhouse gas emissions. They emit CO2, they emit nitrogen oxide, and of course methane from animal rearing and growing. So imagine a 25% contribution if we make a small change in the way we produce, distribute, and consume food, we can make a big difference and make these 12 years, which of course those numbers are always approximative, making them a lot more.
Of course, one of the things which people often cite is that the livestock industry has a big part to play in this.
There are proven technologies that will do what we call climate-smart agriculture, that at the same time promote food security, agricultural production, and rural growth, while they are less invading with respect to the climate. That is, they produce less gases and the types of things that promote climate change. The problem with these technologies is the smallholders that constitute about 8% of all farms in the world, like less than 2 hectares, do not have the capital and the risk reduction capacity to adopt such technology. Anything in agriculture is risky, especially new technology. So somebody with 2 hectares, which is, depends on the 2 hectares to feed the family, it would be difficult to convert them to a new technology if they don't have credit, access to credit, access to risk reduction, etc. So I think the conventional wisdom is that all the negative effects are coming from the big companies. They don't care how it produces, etc. I think we should take all this with a grain of salt. There are big companies that care about the environment. We heard some examples in this conference itself.
We did.
On how, indeed, they are concerned about what are their environmental and climate change footprint. So we shouldn't put all eggs in one basket. On the other hand, we have to recognize that small producers in certain areas, they practice slash and burn agriculture because they have no alternative. So the question is regulation on one hand, especially for the bigger ones, and other means of livelihood for the smaller producers in order to produce more, and incentives to produce more environmentally friendly way.
And there are so many polar opposites within the food debate. I mean, you were talking in your keynote today about the fact that in the world today there's getting on for 1 billion people that are hungry, yet worldwide there are probably twice that number that are overweight. There are, in so many of these debates, there are widely differing views. How have you coped with that in your long and distinguished career of, 29 years at the Food and Agriculture Organization?
Right.
How have you coped with trying to pull these things together and find a coherent way forward?
For us, first of all, you're absolutely right. Some of this debate has been polarized, and people are looking for arguments instead of looking for science. They're a big difference sometimes. What we try to do in FAO is try to bring science in the debate, try to bring evidence, numbers, to see not only what are the trends, but what are the driving factors behind this dichotomy whereby you have malnourished children and badly nourished individuals in the same household that you have obese individuals. As a matter of fact, the 600 million obese people in this world should not be added to the people that are undernourished. That is, some of those people are obese, and at the same time, they're malnourished. Mm-hmm. That is, they don't get the right amounts of vitamins, minerals, macro and micronutrients. Mm-hmm. So the picture is muddled a little bit, and that's why I said the same individual can be obese and malnourished at the same time. Obesity is a form of malnutrition, but it can be also nourished badly in terms of the basic things that one takes in. So FAO is trying to bring the diet and the evidence. In terms of the, obesity pandemic, which is expands, it's probably going to double by 2030 if we're not careful. There is a lot of cheap food going around, loaded with sugar, salt, fats, etc. And this food is becoming affordable, even in the context of the developing countries. Go to a developing country in an urban area and you can find just about anything that you could find in a supermarket fast food section. So food is becoming cheaper, becoming more affordable, but the type of food that's becoming more affordable is not necessarily the type of food that people would need in order to be well-nourished. That's fact number one. Second, people try to isolate foods from the diet. I give you an example, McDonald's. Say, McDonald's is bad. Well, if you have one hamburger every 3 weeks, it's not the problem. The problem is you have a McDonald's a day without any vegetables, etc. That's where it becomes a problem. So we have to be careful about demonizing foods rather than correcting and promoting healthy diets.
Yes, and I think it's so important that higher quality, more nutritious food is cheaper and more available than the current system where a lot of poor quality, high saturated fat, high sugar, salt kind of foods are cheap and ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And I think for my organisation, Compassion in World Farming, we focus quite heavily on industrial agriculture and particularly the perils, as we see it, in rearing animals in factory farms, in cages, crates and confinement. Right. And here we see a big area of food waste, actually, in that keeping animals in confinement means that you have to grow their feed elsewhere, using relatively scarce arable land. And in so doing, we feed about 4 billion people's worth of cereals and soya to those farm animals who waste most of the food value in conversion. What is your view in terms of industrial agriculture in the future and the sustainability parameters that we need to try to achieve?
Some of this debate was today in the opening of this conference. There is no more contested, highly contested food, if you wish, or product as in the livestock. And there are all sorts of accusations and counter-accusations and rationalizations that fly about. One has to look at livestock as, of course, the production of meat and high-quality calories or dairy. And then one can look at livestock as a livelihood asset for small producers in the developing countries. There is a lot of evidence on livestock's long shadow. There was a book published by FAO, Long Shadow, which was talking about the serious environmental impact of raising animals. And in this debate, it's not the case that all large-scale production is guilty and all small-scale production is innocent in terms of the footprint on the environment and on climate change. One has to get the balance. You again, one has to look into the inescapable fact is that in the United States and Europe, the average consumption of meat is 100 kilos and 80 kilos per year per inhabitant. In Africa, it's 10. So the question is, one, from the consumer entry point, is how do we educate the consumers in countries where there is an overconsumption of this type of proteins way beyond the recommended daily allowances to consume less, also for reasons of health, etc. We all know about the animal fats, etc. And at the same time, though, on the supply side, we try to regulate it in a way that it doesn't have the types of impacts that you mentioned, animals which are treated in a way that no one wants to see them treated, etc. The issue of food versus feed, it's another the private sector and government and research have found ways in the past to increase substantially the efficiency of feed to the animals. That is the absorption capacity of the animals, and we probably will look more of it in the future. There are no simple solutions, unfortunately. We have to make sure that high-quality protein from dairy and meat are more available in the developing countries with sustainable forms of production. They don't have to follow the path of some of the industrial agriculture that you mentioned. And on the other hand, more regulation on industrial agriculture to ensure that the footprint they leave is not as big as it is now. I would not put every bit of grain that's used for animal feed as a waste. Waste is a totally different thing. It's certainly reducing the amount of livestock products that we consume in our countries will eventually bring down the amount of grain production that is consumed.
And thinking about us as consumers now, how can we reduce as consumers our impact on the planet? What would be your advice to us in Europe?
First of all, as I said before, I think we consume too much of animal protein, and that has to go down in favor of more plant-based foods. FAO is a big proponent. A diet more balanced in terms of fruits and vegetables. Diets. The nutritionists, one of the most fractious sciences is nutrition. They cannot agree amongst themselves, but there are some elementary things to which they agree. The salt intake, the sugar intake, as I said before, the animal protein intake, animal fats, saturated fats, etc. So I think at least we can say with safety that there are certain of these rules that we should promote in our diet. It's not about, you can't persuade consumers from one day to another to consume half of the quantity of meat that they do. But you can ask them to reduce it and the kinds of meats that they eat. Because not all animal raising has the same impact on the environment and climate change.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. And you know, Compassion in World Farming advocates eating less and better meat, so reducing the amount of meat that we consume, but eating better, as in pasture-fed, free-range, organic, these kind of non-industrial types that, as you say, have a lighter footprint on the planet.
Exactly. The last point I would like to make. One particular product, say cotton, which is very intensive on water, it can have a big environmental footprint in a semi-arid area than in an area which is well endowed with underground water resources. So one has to look at not only the product, but where is the product produced. There is one fact. At this point, if you look at the global numbers, the world has about 1.5 billion hectares of land which could potentially be arable. And we expect to use between now and 2050 only about 100 million hectares. So very small percentage of. A lot of this land, though, is in sensitive, environmentally sensitive areas, watersheds, marginal areas, semi-desert, etc. And it's not what we don't know, or what the problem is that the production increase won't happen in those areas that are well endowed with land, but those that any further use of land. It cuts into forests, fragile wetlands, etc., etc. So one has to be to see where something is produced and what is the endowment in terms of the resources to produce it.
I couldn't agree more, and I think looking at the scale of the challenge, that food is very much at that nexus between climate, the environment, sustainability, and animal welfare, of course. We're now, as an organisation, calling for a global agreement, something akin to the Paris Agreement, to shift food and farming systems to the kind of more balanced, healthy, nutritious diets that you were talking about through a regenerative style of agriculture. What would be your advice to us in taking that project forward?
The existing governance mechanisms for agriculture, for food security, etc., they're plenty. From the G7, we have the G20, the Committee on World Food Security, the Sustainable Development Goals, various industry coalitions, if you wish. One has to see what would be the added value of what you are trying to do and use as much as possible existing mechanisms. There have been proposals for having for agriculture something like the International Panel on Climate Change, but have it for agriculture. It's one additional formation, is one additional governance mechanism, and the world has enough at this point. I'm not trying to discourage you from doing it, but I would encourage you to look at what is already on the table and to what extent you can work through the existing governance mechanisms and then see what the added value of what you're trying to do is. So I'm not giving you a very specific advice. I say look around and let's see then what is the added value that you're trying to do.
Costas, that's very helpful, and yeah, indeed what we're trying to do, what we are showing, is that several important sustainable development goals are unlikely to be met unless we move the food system to something that's more regenerative and, from an animal welfare point of view, more compassionate. So I think I take your advice to heart, and we will work with that. And what I'm keen to know really as a final question, as someone who has been there and seen so much in 3 decades at the UNFAO, and seen the scale of the challenges now facing the food system and sustainability, what gives you hope?
When we go back to the conference, try to see how many business executives, somebody sitting next to me from Syngenta and somebody who I met last night from the Dairy Association in the United States, they wear on their labels the Sustainable Development Goals logo, this circle with the various colors, 17 different colors, which is the Sustainable Development Goals. I didn't expect that. I think it's becoming more and more under also the pressure of public opinion, it's becoming more and more a common knowledge and accepted that the as the Bayer representative said in his speech, our food system is not sustainable. And sustainability is not just environment and it's social sustainability, economic sustainability, and environmental sustainability. So he said the system is not sustainable. We can't continue business as usual. You can't have the system contribute to such an enormous footprint for the environment, leaving 820 million people hungry and having 2 billion people overweight in these kinds of antithesis. Of contradictions, it can be done. I'm hopeful. I think for the reason I mentioned in the beginning, that it's becoming now common knowledge that we are doing a lot of things wrong. And so there is a tendency to recognize that. And so even the private sector is starting to look at what the consumers could demand over time. That is something which is more environmentally friendly, that is produced in a particular way, where it is it produced with child labor or with semi-slave conditions, etc. Those are important things. And I think this bottom-up movement to push the food system from the consumption side towards a better food system, but there is also a top-down from governments, from big corporations, from the private sector in general, from the civil society, which is extremely strong, and it's becoming stronger and having a greater voice in this. Knowledge has to be public. You should bring to the table the consumers and the consumer advocates, the producers, the middlemen, the processors, etc., etc. So it is instances like this which I think we can move in the right direction. I don't know if we can do it in 12 years, but I think we are moving in the right direction.
I think you're absolutely right. The key is to take, if not everyone, then as many people with us as we can, governments, corporations, and civil society, in a big push to save the food system for future generations to enjoy. It's been such a pleasure meeting you, Kostas. Thank you so much for spending the time and for sharing the wealth of experience with me that you've had for so long at the UNFAO. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Thank you.